This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Back in the day, when you went out for a run, all you needed was a Walkman and a pair of wired headphones. Today, probably Bluetooth earbuds have replaced those headphones, and your smartphone has replaced the Walkman. But the smartphone does more than just play music. While you're out on a run, your phone can act as a GPS and keep a log of your route. You can also track how many calories you burn, and even what you eat. Maybe you also have a smartwatch added to the mix to keep track of other health data like sleep patterns and blood pressure and menstruation cycle. All of this prompts the question, how private is that data? And how can people stay safe while sharing their locations using their favorite health apps? We first had a conversation about this last August on the program, and given that a number of us might have received some fancy new health-oriented gadgets over the holidays, or maybe we're starting out the new year with a resolution to do more running or walking and tracking that progress, we thought this would be a good opportunity to revisit that conversation. I talked about this with a professor from the University of Illinois. Because we're on tape for this part of the show, we're not taking calls, but as ever, we'd love to hear what you thought. Email talk at 21stshow.org. That's talk at 21stshow.org. Okay, let's talk about fitness apps and gadgets and privacy. Joining us now to talk about how your data can be breached through health apps and how to keep it safe is Adam Bates, an assistant professor of computer science at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Adam, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here. And actually, I've been an associate professor for about a week.
Oh, congratulations. I did not reflect the promotion. Goodness.
It was pretty good research. Don't worry about it.
Well, I know it takes a lot of work to make that bump. So congrats on that. So let's talk about some of your research. There's a study this year, another one in 2018. And maybe let's start with that 2018 one first. What did you find there?
Yeah, so, you know, as you mentioned, these fitness apps are tremendously popular, especially apps like Strava that let you post maps of your exercise activities online. As you might imagine, though, broadcasting exercise maps to the internet could potentially leak some sensitive information, especially if you're exercising near where you live. Back in 2018, my group investigated a privacy feature offered by many fitness apps called a privacy zone. The privacy zone hid part of your exercise route if it happened near your home, effectively dropping an anonymity circle over your house so that other users couldn't see that part of the exercise. There was a problem, though. If you think back to your high school geometry class, Brian, if I tell you the radius of a circle along with a couple of points that fall on the boundary of that circle, you could probably find its center just by using a simple protractor. So in 2018, my research group effectively created a computer algorithm to act as that protractor, discovering in the process that 95% of the millions of public Strava activities that had used privacy zones could effectively be de-anonymized.
Oh my goodness, Mrs. Lesh somewhere right now is cursing me that I'm not just jumping in here and affirming your geometry.
You don't remember?
It was freshman year. It was a long time ago.
Okay.
But all right, so have there been changes? So this was 2018 that this study came out. Have there been changes made by Strava in an attempt to respond to this?
Yeah, so actually we work with Strava and a number of other companies such that before our research was published, they had already changed the way that they made privacy zones work in an attempt to improve the privacy of their athletes. In a nutshell, if you were to log on to Strava today and set up a privacy zone, your home would be equally likely to fall anywhere within that anonymity circle rather than always being right in the center. So the protractor doesn't work anymore, and hopefully this makes it more difficult for someone to figure out where you live.
And so the circle could just, I guess, kind of, maybe if you picture a map visually, it bounces around so that it's not always
exactly
centered on the home. Okay, mm-hmm. That makes sense. I mean, we're talking about Strava here, and maybe for listeners who aren't familiar, this is a way to people sort of compete. You can sort of run races asynchronously, not at the same time with other people, but you can find a route and then run it and see how you compare to other people. Do these privacy concerns go with other fitness applications as well?
Yeah, so there's a whole ecosystem of these apps, of course. You know, Nike Run, Endomondo, MapMyRun, etc. We focused a lot on Strava because they had some of the most sophisticated privacy precautions at the time that we conducted our work. Unfortunately, it made them a bit of a target for us. But there's a number of companies that offer features like these privacy zones that are specific to fitness apps. There's also, of course, a variety of traditional privacy features that you'd find on other social networks like Facebook, things like making posts private or only sharing them with your friends, things like that.
All right. So that was the 2018 research. Now there's another study this year, 2022, and you found that the average person is able to get precise data location by eyeballing. So this is no longer a computer algorithm. Talk about that.
Yeah. So, you know, of course, back in 2018, we showed that there was theoretically a problem, but that didn't necessarily mean that real users had been at risk when they were using this app. After all, you know, bike thieves don't have advanced computer science degrees, and they might not have had the technical expertise to program that algorithm that we used. So in follow-up work, we were really curious about asking everyday people to try and de-anonymize these privacy zones, which they did using an interactive map tool. And we found that under favorable conditions, like when they had lots of different exercise routes to look at, participants were still able to de-anonymize that original privacy zone implementation with almost 70% accuracy. So it actually seems plausible that some of the real-world crimes that had been linked to fitness app usage over the years could have actually occurred even if those athletes had been using that privacy zone feature. Fortunately, this new study is still only focusing on that original privacy zone implementation. So this isn't saying that athletes are at risk when they use those privacy zone settings today.
So, all right, we asked our listeners about this and whether they use these sort of apps, in you know, how the privacy, you know, how they think about privacy in terms of them. And we got a text message from Abby in Urbana who says that she actually hadn't even thought about this issue until we brought it up in the text message. She also mentioned, though, that she stopped using apps that track period cycles. And I mean, this is something that's been in the news lately with Roe versus Wade. Data about menstruation cycles could get misused, maybe from either a data breach perspective or even from a policy perspective, as states are looking to go after people who take advantage of reproductive health services in other states, or even in their state, I guess. But, you know, have you seen the apps in these, you know, in this area responding, health apps responding to this decision, the Supreme Court decision that overturned the Roe versus Wade precedent?
Yeah, so as a disclaimer, this isn't an area that I've particularly studied, and I'm also not a person that menstruates, but I'm happy to summarize some of the work that we're seeing coming out of the privacy research community. So first, it does seem, I'll start with the bad news, it does seem pretty clear that anti-choice legislators or prosecutors would love an opportunity to try and weaponize data that would be collected on things like period apps. We could look, for example, to the Missouri State Health Department, which back in 2019 compiled a spreadsheet of patients' last menstrual periods as part of an attempt to revoke a Planned Parenthood clinic's abortion license. So at the time, that data wasn't collected from period trackers, it was collected from other medical records, but it's clear that the interest is there. So I'm not a lawyer, and I don't think I can really comment on the legal barriers that would prevent anti-choice organizations from accessing period tracker data. But what I do know as a technologist is that developers of period apps can't be compelled to share data that they don't have. And that's why the choice of period app might actually matter a lot. Researchers from Royal Holloway, University of London, analyzed dozens of these period tracking apps and found that there were big disparities between how data was stored. In some apps, that data never even left the phone, meaning that the app companies couldn't share or sell that information even if they wanted to. In others, though, period data was sent back to the company servers or even shared with third parties directly from your phone. They also found that there were big disparities in how these apps' privacy policies were explained. Some apps were empowering their users to make informed decisions about how their period data was managed. Others seemed to be not so forthright about their data management policies. So if tracking your period is useful to you, look for an app that lets you keep period data on your phone and clearly explains how your data is being used.
Yeah. All right. Let me take a moment to reintroduce Adam Bates, who is an associate professor of computer science at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about privacy. We began talking about running apps and fitness apps. We also were just there talking about menstruation tracking apps and some of the privacy implications of that. But I think what I'm hearing from you is, you know, this gets at the sort of stepping back a degree maybe of the broader question of like local data storage versus cloud data storage. And is that something that comes into play with these fitness apps that you're talking about as well?
You know, I think it really depends on the type of data that we're talking about. There's a lot of, you know, health data such as, you know, you're not necessarily using a menstruation tracker because you want to make a post about it on Facebook. Whereas if you're using something that lets you create in a map of your exercise route, that might be something you want to share with your friends. So I think the type of data we're talking about matters a lot. Of course, you know, this is something we see from big tech all the time. You know, their real business is as data brokers. And so there's a tension there between the use of some of these services and how your data is being handled. But I think that depends on the situation.
Yeah, you remind me of the, was it Jerron Lanier who had that line, if you're not paying for a product, you are the product.
Yep.
In terms of your data. All right, what should those who are privacy conscious do in their apps to keep their data more private and secure?
Yeah, so as part of that 2022 study, we were actually able to connect and survey with over 400 fitness app users and found, you know, far from being oblivious about the potential privacy and safety risks about using fitness apps, they actually had, you know, a variety of different nuanced strategies for making sure that they could use these apps safely. This did include some technical precautions like using those privacy zones or setting posts to private, but even more so, it included non-technical precautions, things like exercising with friends or waiting until you're further away from your house to turn that exercise tracker on. And this makes a lot of sense because yes, there's a cyber element now to exercising with a fitness app. We're not just bringing our Walkman on jogs, but there's also a physical element of performing activities out in the real world. And athletes are already accustomed to thinking about their safety in that context. So we can't just think about privacy as a matter of, you know, sort of software and technical solutions. We also need to think about our real world privacy and safety.
Yeah, I'm reminded of All the President's Men, right? The great Woodward and Bernstein movie, like take three different cabs before you begin your run from a remote location.
Hopefully it's not that extreme. Yeah.
Well, what is the in the minute or so we have remaining, what are the benefits of being able to share this data? And I understand it can even keep people safe while on a run, maybe ironically.
Yeah, you know, I think the results speak for themselves in terms of, you know, how much of a desire there is to use fitness apps. You know, there's a number of companies that have tens or even hundreds of millions of downloads. And, you know, of course, exercise can be, you know, potentially a pretty isolating experience. Being able to, you know, not only connect with your friends and share how you're doing, but even, you know, connect with other athletes that are using the service, you know, say going on a run on a known segment and being able to compete on a leaderboard, all of that can be, you know, powerfully motivating and also an accountability mechanism for continuing to pursue your exercise goals. Other health apps, you know, such as the period trackers that we discussed, can really empower users to better understand and make informed decisions about their own health. So there's a tremendous benefit to using these services. But, you know, in any context, this is a classic tension when we're studying computer security and privacy. There's a trade-off between sharing and privacy and safety. And so, you know, that's why it's important that we explore these tensions and, you know, try to arrive at optimal solutions for everyday users.
Well, Adam Bates, thank you for exploring those tensions with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Adam Bates is an associate professor of computer science at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign's Granger College of Engineering. And we first broadcast this conversation, and I spoke with him back in August of last year. And that's all the time we have for The 21st Show today. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our interns are Owen Henderson, Anaya Jones, and Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.